Now, one of the things that we do is we talk about your religious upbringing first, and then we get into your more current bio.
Yeah.
I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. Grew up mostly in the San Fernando Valley, the emerging white suburbs north of the city. My family was Jewish, and we were kind of pretty much secular Jewish. This was in the 50s, and so the family was trying to assimilate after the Holocaust and after the anti-Semitism in this country.
Mm, sure.
I got some kind of introduction to Judaism and basic Jewish values, but not a real religious sense of it or commitment to it, involvement with it.
Uh-huh. Sure.
I went away to college, and pretty much from college on, I started doing education activism and writing about issues of social justice. Of course, this was the late 60s at first, and the big issues were the war in Vietnam. And so I was part of organizing against that. And then the other part was the kind of the tail end of the civil rights movement and doing racial justice work, both on campus and otherwise. Mm-hmm. Pretty much I define myself as an educator, activist, and writer. And for the last several decades, I've been doing various kinds of community work. When the women's liberation movement came along, some of us who were men wanted to do something to support their work. We knew women who were setting up rape crisis centers and battered women's shelters. And we went to some of them and we said, well, what can we do? We'd like to support your work. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we're dealing with the survivors of male violence and our hands are full, but it's men who are doing the violence, and you're men, so talk to the men.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So we said, well, is there anything else we can do? Maybe some child care or some office sweeping or filing or anything but talking to the men. Because they were the bad guys, and we were, in our minds anyway, the good guys. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted to be separate from them. They were very clear that that's what they needed men to be doing. And so it was one of my first lessons of what does it mean to be an ally. Is you can't just walk in and decide what you want to do, but you have to listen to people on the front lines and do what's needed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we set up the Oakland Men's Project in 1979 to work with men on issues of male violence. Hmm. And at that point, my partner and I had our first child, who was a boy. Then we had a girl, and then we had another boy. So I was working on gender issues, male violence out in the community, and having to come home and figure out our relationship and how to raise kids in a different kind of way than we had been raised back 10, 20 years earlier.
Sure. Wow.
So things kind of came together in that period and set the course for the next many years after that.
Okay, so you don't have a real staunch or devoted religious background?
No, I mean, I identify as being Jewish, but secularly Jewish.
Yeah.
My personal spiritual practice is kind of a combination of some pagan, some Jewish, some Taoist kinds of practices, but I don't claim affinity with a religious identity.
Yeah.
Or a religious institution.
So when it comes to God, what do you believe about God?
I know nothing about God.
There you go.
Tell us all
I
about
love that answer, really, because that's
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
I'm always interested. You know, it's sure. An interesting discussion, but
you seem like a pseudo mystic of sorts, where you're open to spirituality, but just none of this dogmatic stuff.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it.
Okay, so but the thing that really caught my eye. We had a guy on named Fred Rich, and he wrote a book called Christian Nation, and it was a fictional book, kind of a Handmaid's Tale of sorts of encroaching Christian theocracy in America using Sarah Palin as the president, where instead of Obama winning, McCain won, McCain dies, she becomes president, and the story goes on from there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating stuff because we feel encroaching Christian theocracy all the time, and then Bob uses this word a lot, and I've always struggled with how to pronounce it. But hegemony,
hegemony. Yeah.
See, I've said hegemony, you know, before on the air.
Hegemony. Actually, it's an Italian word.
Okay.
A guy by the name of Antonio Gramsci came up with it back in the 30s, between the 30s and the 60s. He was a hated man by Mussolini. Okay. As the rise of power, you know, Mussolini's rise. And so he got, he was an intellectual, so he got put in a jail. He got put in jail for 30 years, and he died in jail. But he kept something called the prison notebooks. And in the prison notebooks was this notion of eugenomia. Hey, eugenomia, you know?
Edging which, on me?
No, eugenomia. That's how the Italians would say it.
Okay.
Eugenomia, which means in the presence of power.
Okay.
In the presence of
power.
So
that's Italian for presence of power.
Well, yeah, and he was, you know, he was a Marxist. That is, Gramsci was a Marxist.
Sure.
So Marx said eventually, you know, the proletariat, the working class, will rise up and will take over the bourgeoisie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that didn't happen. And Antonio Gramsci said, how come that didn't happen? What's going on? And this notion then became a part of Marxist belief, this component called hegemony.
Okay.
And we're going to talk a little bit to Paul about
that. Christian hegemony. So that's really the main thing that we're interested in is your book and your thesis there, and what do you see happening?
Yeah, Paul.
I think that's a good place to start, because hegemony really means dominance,
mm-hmm.
but it means dominance that's so deep and long standing that people don't even see it as dominance anymore. It just become part of the way things are.
Okay, so we could use the frogs are being boiled, you know.
Yeah,
that
whole thing. Or the fish is, the fish, that fish joke as far as how's the water, and the other one says, what's water?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's a very good way to put it.
Okay.
It's an ideology where we're in, it's like we're fish in water. We can't see the water.
Yeah.
We can't see the ideology. Ideology is in us. We are in it.
Yeah.
Land animals can see the water. And Christians are inside the water of dominant Christianity. But for those of us who are on the outside, Native Americans, Muslims, Jews, pagans, atheists, it's very clear that we're in a Christian dominant society.
Yeah.
So hegemony applies to those who have drunk the Kool-Aid or are inside the system.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The name of the book is Living in the Shadow of the Cross, Understanding and Resisting the Power and Privilege of Christian Hegemony. So this is Christian hegemony. And how far back should we go with this, Paul? When you say, I mean, I guess you could say you go both as far back as the Roman Empire, you know, when Constantine became a Christian. And then the can you imagine the power of the Roman Empire behind you? We're still vibrating to that today when you think about it.
You know, in 381, the Roman Emperor declared that Christianity was the only acceptable religion in the entire Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So not only did all pagans and Jews become second-class citizens, vulnerable to violence, but the edict also said there was only one Orthodox legitimate Christianity, a certain way of understanding the relationship between the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and every other Christian was heretical and therefore vulnerable to violence and exclusion and marginalization. So you can really date very specifically the rise to dominance of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to make a couple of distinctions before we go any further, because I'm not really talking about individual Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Individual Christians have lots of different beliefs and lots of different relationships to dominant Christianity.
Sure.
So this isn't an attack on anybody's personal beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also not talking about Christianity per se, because there's lots of different alternative Christianities.
Yep.
And many of them have been in opposition to dominant Christianity.
Uh-huh.
You have Black Church, you have liberation theology, you have feminist theologies, Native American Christianities and things. So what we're talking about is a system of domination that started back then and over the many centuries has consolidated wealth and power and a worldview that dominates all aspects of our lives. That's what I mean when I say Christian dominance or Christian hegemony.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the first places you go to when we talk about Christian hegemony or any kind of hegemony, but I guess Christian hegemony for sure, is language. Language is key. It's how did I think you mentioned it in one of your books. It's the basis of empire or something like that, right?
If you have the power to define things, then you kind of begin to create a reality in a society. And when you define certain classes of people, as being other, inferior, less than fully human, which Christianity, dominant Christianity, has done, then it becomes accepted. It allows slavery to happen and genocide to happen because those people aren't really fully human.
I was going to say, you probably have a nose for that with your history with the Holocaust. Is
right.
that Hitler began to, they called the Jews the rats, and there was all this different terminology and symbolism that was represented over a certain demographic, that it became easier and easier to demonize, to monsterize, to animalize a whole people group.
Yeah.
Right. At that point, when it's so instilled in an entire society, then a whole lot of people don't have to be on your side to enforce this, because a whole lot of people have just accepted that that's the way it is, and it really doesn't make any difference, or it's not important whether the Jews are around or not, or Native Americans are around or not, or et cetera, that the entire society becomes a collusion around the marginalization and violence against anybody designated as the other.
Yeah.
And, of course, this happened in Europe with women during the Inquisition and witch-burning times. Women were a group designated as the other, and we can still see this today in our public policy, the war on women, the battle against reproductive rights and equal pay and violence against women.
Absolutely.
Other groups were Muslims, pagans, people with disabilities were a group of others that were considered dangerous, people who were sexually what we would call today lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. These are all groups, and heretics, those that were labeled by the church as not really Christian.
Right.
These were groups that not only were they labeled other and marginalized, they were considered dangerous because underneath all of these groups was the devil. This was seen as part of a cosmic battle between good and evil. And if you're not on the side of good, it's not just that you're out there someplace else. You're on actively colluding with the devil and trying to undermine God's work in the world.
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
This is a theology of evil that loops together a whole lot of what we call different systems of oppression, racism, sexism, things like that, and makes a white Christian male normality. It wields together power and wealth in a very small percentage of the population.
That's right. And one of the things that, one of the little things, the dirty little secrets about, it's not really a secret, about hegemony is we participate in our own domination.
Yeah.
Even though it's bad for us, we participate in our own domination. That's part of the things that Gramsci found. And we don't even know it. We don't even know it. That's the thing. Yeah.
I mean, it's a process of internalizing the values.
Mm-hmm.
So if you grow up all of your life hearing that your people are weak, inferior, to blame for the problems, then you begin to believe it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start acting it out against each other.
Yeah.
Start blaming each other for our problems.
One of the aspects of this that I find so amazing, and this is a psychological thing, is that you get this symbolism, you get this language so embedded in your culture. This is the water you're swimming in, such that whenever that which has been given the power and that which has been given the weakness, I mean, all these different classes and such, when the weaker speaks truth to power, or when we try to, you know, get the city council to stop praying before meetings, it's so woven into their heads that this is the norm that they perceive that as persecution.
Right. They claim victimhood status.
It's crazy.
But they're under attack.
I mean, have you tried to look under the hood psychologically of what goes on in the human psyche when that happens?
Well, it's a defensive reaction. Within Christianity, of course, there's a brief period in early Christian history in which Christians were attacked by the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And so there's this this mythology around martyrdom within Christianity. So Christians can go to that place very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also a way to claim that people are attacking them. It's like the attacks on the war on Christmas, right?
I was just going to mention
Christmas
that.
Christmas is everywhere, right? It dominates our society for 2 months a year, and even longer.
Yes,
and
that's true.
Those of us who aren't Christian, we can't avoid it. And yet when we protest and say, this is a little too much, let's dial it back just a little bit, we're accused of being Uncle Scrooge and spoiling, raining on the Christmas parade.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. And this Kim Davis thing that recently happened when, you know, she was saying, there is a higher God. I listen to God, not the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And it's like, what? You know, you're right. You're right.
She was persecuted.
She was right. And that's certainly not true. But I mean, we kiss the butts of Christians, you know,
trying to exercise her own Christian hegemony,
mm-hmm.
and then being stopped from doing so, not only by the Supreme Court, but by this demographic that wants to get married, wants the same rights as you.
Mm-hmm.
She took on the victim spirit. She took on the victim.
So that's like a go-to trope. That's a go-to place, right, for a lot of Christians. But, like, you're trying to get us.
Well, and men do that when women raise issues about male empowerment, mm-hmm. and white people do it routinely when issues of racial equity are brought up.
Yep.
It's part of the way in our society we've been trained that if we have privilege and it gets questioned, that to claim victim status to try to get out from under owning and being responsible for the privileges and benefits that we get from the system.
It's just a knee-jerk reaction. It's what happens in all these cases every time. It's the first go-to. It's almost it's the easiest thing. It's a no-brainer, but
those who are involved in Christian hegemony, it is the knee-jerk.
Well, or even white supremacy. I mean, he's using it as a broad brush. This is a human reaction to the threatening of their privilege. It's the first go-to. I'm a victim.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's a human reaction.
Okay.
It's a Western civilization reaction.
Good.
Because of the way we define power and victimization and the whole history of Christianity, I think this is pervasive in our society. But it's not one thing that dominant Christianity does is it makes generalizations about the entire world based upon Christianity having the truth. So. One thing I've been trying to learn myself is not to make those kind of broad, universal generalizations, because that's the kind of thing that dominant Christianity generally tries to do.
Sure. But when you say that dominant Christianity or Christian hegemony controls and defines things like the very symbols that surround us, maybe you could talk about that. I know that's part of language, symbols,
sure.
what have you, but what about that?
Right. Well, I mean, there's obvious symbols like the cross. There's other symbols like the phrase "In God We Trust" on our currency,
mm-hmm.
or a Christmas tree. So there's lots of a wide range of symbols and images and words that are part of the dominance. Most people see the phrase "Merry Christmas." They don't think about it being the winter season. People think about it being Christmas season. I've had people tell me that "In God We Trust" is just a neutral statement. you know, everybody believes in God, and therefore it doesn't say the Christian God. We end up going to great length to interpret things to be universal to hide the fact that they are very specific.
Mm-hmm.
New Year's Eve, all the celebration that, well, that's the Christian holiday cycle. That's a Christian calendar that starts with the birth of Jesus and you know, it's divided into two periods, one before his life and one afterwards. Muslims, Jews, Hindus, the Chinese, all kinds of people have different New Year's.
Right.
But we accept that as being the New Year. We have to specify if we're talking about the Vietnamese New Year or the Muslim New Year.
Right.
So it's the way that those things get normalized in our language and our thought patterns and even in our daily cycles around the annual calendar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
It's a part of the construct that keeps you Christian. Like, I mean, I, you know, having grown up in that, it literally is just, this is the way we do things here.
Yeah.
And that's what we had Dan Barker on a few weeks ago, and there was a school in Tennessee that was teaching Bible in a public school setting And they FFRH came in to sue them, and the defense was, hey, this is our history here, you know?
Yeah.
And that really was and is the mindset that this is part of when you start to deconstruct, which just a little bit about myself, Paul, is I was an evangelical for the first 39 years of my life. And began to question and deconstruct, and it was really, really hard. It was really, really difficult, painful, lonely, all the things we talk about on the show. That's the reason this show exists, is because people are on this journey. And we currently have friends and fans of the show that are taking medication for their anxiety and their post-religious stress disorder because it's so hard to step out from this hegemony that is just woven into your fabric, your DNA, mm-hmm. your social fabric. This is a big deal.
Absolutely. And to name and question the whole dominant system is a big deal as well, because it's so invisible mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it's so threatening to people. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we've been talking about some of the kind of the minor aspects of Christian dominance, the language, the images. What's even more significant is a couple of other areas. One is the power and wealth accumulated in Christian institutions.
Mm-hmm. Boy,
they actually have political power.
Oh, yeah.
And that influence public policy and foreign policy. So we could talk about that. And then the other piece that I want to get to is the worldview, the kind of the core values that shape the way we see the world and interpret events and our behavior and everything else within, that's also extremely important in large scale and harder to pinpoint or to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So when it comes to their political power and their money and their voting base, and that they do, they're a juggernaut of power,
yeah.
Even though they feel victimhood. They're definitely a powerhouse.
Yeah.
Even Focus on the Family has a seven-figure annual income.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, it really is. And of course, every year, Obama participated in it as well. There's the National Church Breakfast. They're the, you know, the
prayer breakfast.
And the National Day of Prayer is the first Thursday of every month.
Yeah.
I participated in it all the time. Yeah.
Wow. So that's always there, and that eventually doesn't even get talked about or thought about. It just is, right?
Well, the other thing, Paul, is legislation. I mean, I think the reason that everybody's so concerned about the 2016 election is primarily for who's going to replace, these Supreme Court justices that are aging, mm-hmm. because there's the power.
Mm. Right. And I think we can disassemble that a little bit, that some of that power lies in the denominations. In the Mormon Church, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Evangelicals, the religious institutions that have tremendous amount of land and wealth and influence and constituencies that they can organize to vote in certain ways,
right.
and for certain kinds of ideas.
Yeah, I remember in your book you talked about Prop 8 and how the Mormons got behind that and defeated it. You know,
right.
in California, I mean, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Another level of the power is the power that individual preachers, ministers, and priests have in our society, in communities, in large churches, and even in the halls of Washington.
Yeah.
Billy Graham is an obvious large-scale figure in that arena, but there's many, many religious leaders who have considerable power. Political power, not only because of their access to their constituencies and the mega churches, but also because of their access to the public media and other resources, broadcasting networks, universities, etc.
Yeah, Reverend Warren, Rick Warren.
Yeah.
He's another example, right?
Yeah, well, one thing that Bob and I talk about all the time is the bizarro world that we find ourselves in. And I'm telling you, when the Pope came to the United States, I am in awe. My head exploded. It does every time anybody even ever drops his name. The fact that even at the highest freaking level, we seem to have forgot that he's a human being that shits and eats just like the rest of it. He is not the vicar of Christ. And most people kind of know that. And yet, when he speaks, the world listens. And there's just something very creepy and cultish about large groups of people foregoing their common sense and rationality to even give that motherfucker the time of day.
Tell us what you really think. How about that?
It just blows my mind.
Yeah.
Well, and that is a power of Christian dominance, that this is a person who represents, quote unquote, billions of Christians throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a clear sign of deference that people have to Christian power and wealth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's telling that this Pope, who, you know, I respect his statements about about poverty and economic equality and about climate change. But in fact, he's just a person at the head of a tremendously power and longstanding institution. And the practices of that institution have not changed.
Right.
They're not opening up their coffers to feed the poor in any significant way. They're not divesting from fossil fuel industries. They're not doing anything behind the rhetoric.
Right.
And at the same time, he canonized Father Juan Nipero Serra, who was the head of the missionary system in California and was immediately responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of indigenous people throughout California.
Yeah.
And he just sanctified him and made him into a saint just a couple of months ago.
Yeah. And they're still misogynist too.
Yeah.
So, the system goes on, and that's why we have to separate the individuals who hold power at certain times from a dominant system that perpetuates itself. Mm-hmm. Another major area, and you mentioned focus on the family, but is the whole area of parachurch organizations. Mm-hmm. The tens of thousands of nonprofit Christian-led organizations that are tax exempt. They have they garner a tremendous amount of government and our money, taxpayers' money, to further agendas, to proselytize, to push a dominant Christian agenda.
Lobby.
Some of them are prison fellowship, Campus Crusade for Christ, World Vision, which is a $1 billion overseas aid organization. Of course, Jeff Charlotte wrote a lot about the family, which has a lot of political connections and influence,
in
just
Congress,
in the United States, but in many other countries. Mm-hmm. Like I said, there's broadcasting corporations, there's universities, there's think tanks, there's legal foundations. There's just a vast, comprehensive network of different organizations working to push a dominant Christian agenda.
Mm-hmm. And it's the way we think. You talk about that in the book as well, the way we think. I mean, from everything, from judgment to our own bodies, the way we deal with, relate to our own bodies. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the what I call the key Christian concepts.
Sure.
One of them is the dualism, the fact that everything is divided up into good and evil, good, bad. And, you know, I started watching my own language and realized how often during the day I label things good or bad.
Right.
He's a good kid, right? She's a bad girl. It's good weather. It's bad weather.
Mm. Yep. So it's that binary kind of dualism.
And it's always evaluating and judging.
A quick judgment and put it aside. And, you know, I started to think, well, the weather isn't good or bad. Right? It's not a moral quality. It just is. If it's raining, that's good for a farmer who needs rain on their crops. It's bad if you're planning a picnic. So it's inconvenient or it's useful, but it's not morally good or bad, right?
Right, right.
Things are rarely so. We live in a complex world. Things are complicated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Dominant Christianity has taken that basic dualism that it's founded on and turned that into a cosmic battle between good and evil. So it's no longer just that something is bad, but it's on the side of evil. Mm-hmm. It's, as Bush said, you're either with us or against us. everything gets divided between the good guys and the bad guys. And, of course, we're always the good guys, right?
Of course.
Well, and that phrase originated with Jesus himself. You either for me or you're against me. Yeah.
Right, sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And so when you label something as bad, you're throwing it away. You're making it dangerous. You're making it completely separate from us. Mm-hmm. That's why we have a foreign policy based on a war against evil and the axis of terror. I mean, what more specific Christian framework do we need to identify it?
Well, one of the things you talked about also is in the key Christian concepts area would be that sinners need to be saved. There has to be salvation. And what about that?
Well, it comes basically out of a deep individualism within dominant Christianity that we all ultimately stand alone. We make a personal choice to accept Jesus or accept God or not, and then we stand alone in judgment before God at the end. So we don't have a collective relationship to God the way many other peoples do, mm-hmm. And that we're born into sin, and that all of our lives we have this leaning towards sinfulness, and therefore we need to be saved. We're not. What it does is it means that we're not inherently okay. Our bodies are not okay. Our desires are not okay. Who we love is not okay.
Right.
It's all needs fixing, and we can't do it ourselves. Other people can't do it for us. Only God can do it for us.
Sure, sure.
So there's the deference to power, because we're taught to not trust ourselves. And that when a supreme leader, when Kim Jong-un comes in to that scenario and says, by the way, I'm the supreme leader, we're just conditioned to submit and cede our autonomy and agency on a whim.
So it seems, that's very true. What about, even in the Bible, it says, be fruitful and multiply, you have dominion over the earth, which is now, this is encroaching on my life and my, you know what I mean? If we don't...
Well, it's domination theology, and I'm sure he addresses
that. If we don't hurry up, we better watch ourselves.
I should say dominionism is what it's called.
It is dominionism. But what about that, Paul?
Well, I think it's at the root fundamentally of our whole economic system, the fact that because the earth isn't sacred, the only thing that really is sacred is heaven and being with God.
Yep.
And then it doesn't really matter what happens on earth.
Right.
And we were given dominion over it, so we can do whatever we want to.
Yeah.
And that's allowed unbridled greed and ecological devastation throughout the world.
Well, there's a scripture in the Bible that says the earth is going to be discarded like an old garment, like a dirty laundry.
Mm.
And
a
new heaven, a new earth is going to be provided. So there again is that apathy over creation or over the ecosystem. Yeah.
Wow.
Jeez. Right. And so it's really hard to organize people to think about being interdependent with all life and with the earth and living in balance with the earth if you come at it with a fundamental assumption that humans have dominion over it, and it really doesn't make much difference anyway because it's not such a big deal if it all goes up in flames.
Right.
And in fact, there's some people that hope it will go up in flames because then the final time, the end times will come, and those who are in God's grace will be saved, and the rest of us will be thrown into those flames.
I think that's worth repeating, and I know in the Christian and the atheist world we say it a lot. I know Hitchens said it a lot, but it needs to be said that this ideology fosters an idea that not only makes you not care about the earth, but actually makes you excited about its demise.
Wow. Well,
particularly if you believe in the apocalypse.
Exactly.
And
it's the return of Christ. This is when life begins for these motherfuckers.
Well, the most recent poll showed that about 50% of the adults in the United States believe that the end times, the apocalypse, will happen within their lifetime. So this is not an abstract belief in this country.
Right.
It's built into our culture at very deep levels.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just can't get very moved or motivated to make changes in their lives or in our community around environmental justice, around ecological issues, because of this assumption.
Paul, what about this notion as well that Christians are just, and books have been written about this too, this notion of purity, living pure, the Puritans, and on and on. I mean, I guess it goes back to bodies and feelings and what have you.
Yeah, I think it's very much tied to that we start out as sinful, impure, tainted by original sin, and therefore the struggle is to purify ourselves mm-hmm. at whatever cost, whatever. Because this cosmic battle, Augustine in the 4th century said, there's not only a cosmic battle out there between good and evil, but it's reproduced in each one of us internally between our leaning inclination towards God and our leaning or inclination towards the devil and sin.
Wow.
And so it sets us up internally to be constantly divided against ourselves, against our feelings, against our connections with other people.
Yeah. Well, and when I was a Christian in the 80s, really the emphasis in the 70s and 80s was kind of rock music as far as what you're going to demonize, what you're going to hate, and what you're going to push against is evil, evil rock music, Satanism and stuff like that. But in the 90s, the focus of the Christian of Christendom for animosity was secular humanism. Mm. And it was because of how prideful it is for us as humans to think that we have the answers, that we can fix this. And you know what they refer back to is the Tower of Babel.
Really?
Uh-huh.
The Tower of Babel was this giant tower that humans were building, and God is quoted in that ancient text as saying, there is nothing that they cannot do when they're unified like this. When they put their hands together, human beings, mm-hmm. when they put their hands together and they unify and to a common end, there's nothing that they cannot do, and therefore he thwarted it with mixing up their languages. So all of a sudden, he confused their minds and languages such that they couldn't understand each other, which caused divisions, which stopped the building of the tower. And in some ways, that's where they say the different ethnicities came from, is because everybody went their separate ways that, you know, according to the language they could speak. Anyway, the Bible is clear that God is against humans getting together and doing something without him. He doesn't want to be excluded. He wants to be the center, and so the message is, you can do nothing without me. Wow. And when you think you can, you're prideful.
Wow.
You can see how this sets up ecological disaster, the inability of people, or the doubting and lack of self-confidence that people have about their own desires, about their own feelings, about their own sense of what is right and wrong, when they're constantly being told that they don't have the ability, that they're compromised, they're sinful, they're in error, they don't have the truth.
Right.
Another dominant Christian concept is that there is only one truth, mm-hmm. and it resides within Christianity.
In the Bible.
And so it means that all other cultures, rituals, beliefs are fundamentally flawed, and not just flawed, but dangerous.
Yeah, deceived.
Because they threaten the truth of Christianity.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a cool thing. One of the things that we always say within atheism, as opposed to it, kind of almost in a debate context or apologetics or something, and that is, aren't you lucky that you were born in the country that gave you the right religion and all these, you know, which is really only like 7% of the population, and everybody else, you know. So the way that I used to justify that is that it's not God's fault that all these counterfeit religions came up. In fact, Satan is the source of every counterfeit religion. Like if Jesus was this bright and shining, obvious Lord of Lords, then everybody would just say yes to him and submit. But what Satan did is he created a bunch of clone Jesuses and or at least light and authoritative figures, and just surrounded Jesus so that when the crowd was trying to choose which God to serve, it was confusing because Satan had created all these counterfeits. But Jesus was still the right and only one way. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. I'm the way. I'm the only way.
Okay.
Another key concept in the dominant Christian worldview.
Absolutely.
It's another of the pieces that holds it all together.
Wow.
I think we've talked about most of the ones that are worth mentioning. I want to just mention one more, which is that there's a concept within dominant Christianity of love, and it's within a theology of hierarchy and dominance. So we are all underneath God. God loves us, but God is also superior and dominates us, and we should submit. Men dominate over women. Adults dominate over children. Slave masters dominate over slaves. They should love and take care of those they love and dominate. And the role of those who are being dominated is to be submissive, to obedient, to accept and appreciate the love that they're being given by this dominant figure. Mm-hmm. And so it's a society based on dominant and hierarchical relationships, but it's coded over with this mystique of love, that yeah. love makes it okay. And if you hit your children, if you're a parent, but you do it because you love them for mm-hmm. their own good, because you fear for their salvation,
yeah.
then that's okay.
Right.
Or if a man hits a female partner because he loves her and he doesn't want her, but she's disobedient, she's mm-hmm. too wild, she's not following the Christian way, then again, it's okay to use violence in the name of love.
Yeah, because the model begins with God. God is the one that sets that standard.
And right, and God punishes those who aren't obedient.
Yeah, King James says he chastises those he loves. And so you're lucky if you get abused by God. You know, you're lucky if you get abused.
Oh,
by
really?
That means you love me. I'm telling you, man, this is another one of these layers of really twisted up stuff in that they have merged. I love this. This is great. Paul, they have merged the concept of power and authority with love. And as we've said many times on the show before, I think that they're opposites. Like, in a way, they're mutually exclusive. You can't exercise power and love at the same time, and yet only in this Christian context and this twisting of definitions and this framework of melding them together, that when God loves you, he's also authoritative over you.
Yeah.
And it just becomes this merged concept, when in fact, I think it needs to be divided concept. That when love serves, not overarches. And in some ways, some of Jesus' teaching usurps that. Some of Jesus' teaching supports the servanthood of love, like washing feet mm-hmm. and, you know, love your enemies, you know, because mm-hmm. obviously the power struggle would say dominate your enemies over, you know, overpower your enemies. And anyway, it gets crazy.
Well, I think that that's really important, is that Jesus says a number of things in the New Testament, some of which are contradictory, and people pick and choose what they want to be the true mm-hmm. Jesus. Their Jesus, but dominant Christianity has established over the centuries a certain perspective on what the New Testament means.
Mm-hmm.
It has drawn the statements and the analogies that it wants to hold up as authoritative. And so individual Christians pull lots of different statements from the New Testament
mm-hmm.
and construct a Christianity that's meaningful for them. And which is fine, and that's different than what we face in our society as a dominant worldview.
Okay, so you're pointing to something to where you've alluded to it earlier, that there's so many different Christianities, and we've said on the show before, there's probably a Christianity per Christian. Basically, everybody does kind of uniquely shape and selectively pick and cherry pick the scriptures to, like, this is important to me, this is not. I believe in hell, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in substitutionary atonement. I don't. Some Christians don't even believe that the Bible is inerrant, whereas others insist that you must. Okay?
Yeah.
So you got all these different kind of Christians, and every now and then you do get one of these Christians, and we've had many of them on the show, and they have embraced very selectively a very cool Jesus and a very loving Jesus and a Jesus that says, okay, ISIS has just struck Paris. That doesn't mean we strike back. We take the moral high ground. And we look for other ways for love and art and mm-hmm. expression to overthrow or usurp this evil. But we don't take up the sword.
Mm-hmm.
Those who live by the sword die by the sword. So there's all these contradictory scriptures that where you have coming out of this one faith, if you will,
mm-hmm.
war hawks.
Hawks and doves. Mm-hmm.
And then you have doves coming out of the same Bible, producing very polar ideologies. But one of the things that I just want to say, and this is kind of a side note, and that sometimes atheist podcasts like this one or others are criticized for, is that why aren't you condemning all of it? Because in a way, it's all a waste of time. Even on Bill Maher last week, he had on a Muslim woman who happens to be a feminist, but she's still a Muslim, and he celebrates her.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he's completely, almost anti-theist, at least she's standing up for. And that's what I want to say about those of us that are in this conversation of theism, anti-theism, and all of this, is that one of the reasons that we, in at least at this stage of human history, that we go ahead and celebrate Ben Corey, Jim Henderson, and Jeff Little, and all the Christians that we've had on this show that I celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I think their theism needs to go and all of that, but at least they're leading and advancing a form of Christianity that counters this hegemony, mm-hmm. that counters this nonsense.
That's exactly what I think we should talk about is resistance, because hegemony is never complete. There's always resistance, and there's been a long history of resistance to dominant Christianity from within Christianity, mm-hmm. Christians. For instance, when Spain was committing genocide against Native Americans in the Americas, there were Spanish priests who stood up against that and went to Spain and argued in front of the king to stop the violence that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
During the Jewish Holocaust, there were German Christians who tried to organize and resist with the Nazis. As similar, there were abolitionists here who were guided by their Christian values to work for abolition of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always been resistance. And of course, from the outside of Christianity, there's always been resistance as well. So Native Americans have been resisting for over 500 years the colonization and genocide against their peoples.
Yeah.
And there's today, there's all kinds of ways that both Christians and non-Christians are fighting against dominant Christianity. And some of you've probably interviewed some of the folks from the atheist community or the Religious Freedom Foundation or the Religious Military Freedom Network and all kinds of groups that are fighting for equality, for an end of domination and oppression, for justice in all aspects of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So by doing this, you think by resisting, as you said, there's always resistance. How long will it take until we see a change here, Paul?
He probably doesn't claim to be a prophet.
It sounds like it's going to. Well, I mean, it took several, it took several thousand years to get us where we are. Maybe it's going to take that long, too.
It's in a way, it's never ending, right? Because just as soon as one power is crushed, another one rises up. I mean,
I think we do have to realize these are long term struggles.
Sure.
It took a couple hundred years more even to eliminate slavery in the United States.
Yeah.
So when we talk about struggles for social justice, we're talking about tremendous changes that we want to see in the kinds of world we live in. That doesn't mean that we have to wait for that time to begin creating the alternatives now, to have the vision, to be working to build community, alternative structures, alternative organizations, alternative relationships. And many people are doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a dual front. It's about having a vision of a different world and beginning to build that. And it's about resisting the dominant structures that are trying to attack and destroy our lives.
This just sounds to me, I mean, we talk a lot about Joseph Campbell on this show and the hero's journey and all the archetypes. And in a way, hearing Paul's perspective of this mm-hmm. overreach of Christian hegemony, this language of resistance, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. that just immediately pops up Star Wars, the Hunger Games.
Yeah.
I mean, you name a giant narrative,
mm-hmm.
And it's always a resistance to power.
People are pushing back. Yes.
People are pushing back. And mm-hmm. so it's this overarching human narrative in both reality and fiction. It's just a part of what it means to be alive,
It's human condition,
I think we have to look at that critically, too, as well, because so much of our heroes have been other white male Christians who come and rescue us, right? The cowboys or the military or the Star Wars heroes. So what we want is not a – we don't want to be rescued. We're not looking for a savior.
Oh,
so we want
great point.
Our heroism to reflect a more democratic empowerment and leadership from all aspects of our society and all communities together, mm-hmm. and not to just perpetuate the same old tropes that white male Christian men are the ones who can do it all, can save everybody, can rescue the women, et cetera, et cetera.
You sound like Occupy Wall Street. Seriously, that's their mindset. And wouldn't – I mean, Paul, I don't know if you have a pulse on the millennials, but it seems like the emerging generations already get that.
Well, good.
It's hard to characterize a generation.
There you go.
With any kind of accuracy. I think there are some more egalitarian kinds of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly those young people who have good educations and wealth and white privilege and male privilege are acting in our campuses and in our workplaces pretty much like they have been. So it's always complicated by people's position in and identities in our communities.
Yeah.
True. Yeah. In fact, I'm glad. So right there, he made two comments. We need to be critical of it always just being a white male savior.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes into it's complicated,
mm-hmm.
and boy, is that not evident this last week at Yale,
mm-hmm.
and at the University of Missouri or wherever the president, the mm-hmm. chancellor was stepped down, and that is at least this thing at Yale
mm-hmm.
is this started over a Halloween costume,
really.
And that there was like basically something went out that's saying, hey, be sensitive this Halloween with how you dress up.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be offensive. You know, if you're dressing up as a Native American, it could be mm-hmm. offensive. You're whatever. And there was a white female professor who sent out an email that basically said, yes, and let's not get into censorship. Or get into the removal of free speech, or even the flippancy by which Halloween exists, in that this is a goofy day. This is almost a day to be,
yeah.
set aside to be politically incorrect.
Right, a carnival, sort of.
A carnival, so, yeah. so it's like, let's mm-hmm. maybe the rules change a little
upside
bit on
down.
Halloween, and maybe you can get a little tougher skinned or something, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, howdy, did that backfire to these young students. And I've witnessed, well, we all witnessed maybe that video of that one young black girl just shouting at the top of her lungs this close to the face of the husband, the professor husband of the professor wife that wrote that email. And she said, who hired you? Who do you think you are? Why are you here? You're not listening to anybody, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Screaming at the top of her lungs. And then she just storms away in the video. And I have a few conservative friends. And one guy wrote, he tweeted, he said, you don't know how much pleasure it gives me to see these professors attacked by the monsters they created.
Ooh.
Because her fragility, I mean, in a way, I call it that. I mean, to some extent, she's right as far as, like, we got to be sensitive, we got to be PC. Anyway, my point, Paul, is this is just very, very complicated.
Well, it isn't and isn't in some ways. You know, incidents like that aren't started by a costume. They're started by 500 years of colonial history.
There you go. That's the context.
They're triggered by these things.
I see.
But they're in the context of the police brutality and the murder of black young people in our streets by the rise of the KKK and right-wing militia in many of our communities.
Sure.
She's not being fragile.
Okay.
She's being traumatized by the violence directed at her and her community, and this is a trigger for expressing that.
I think this is exactly what Michael Steele said on Bill Maher's show. He said, look, if you think she's being fragile, if you think she's a monster, then you simply lack the context.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Paul is saying. Good point.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. We've got about an hour of tape, and it's been some heavy, serious stuff. And
I had one question.
Okay, one more serious question.
Before we leave, Paul, you know, you talk. It's a, by the way, this book is a wonderful book, one you should have in your library, I think, out there, folks. But you talk about the...
he's holding it up.
That's right. You talk about the coming of Constantine. There was this great war. Constantine was in the east, and Maxentius and others were in the west. The big war happened, and at the Milvian Bridge, Constantine wins, right? And then he turns into a Christian. Have you ever thought about what would happen
what
if Constantine would have lost at the Milvian Bridge that day?
Like you said earlier, I'm not a prophet. I'm not a prognosticator.
Wow, because think about it, everything flows from that. You know, the great cathedrals of Europe, the great art, the poetry, the, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, you name all the Western stuff we know about. What the hell would we have?
Well, you're saying that two roads diverged in yellow wood, and that made all the difference. That's the why in the road that changed everything.
That's right. So I don't know. I guess you can't really talk about it.
You can speak to that, Paul.
Well, I mean, it's impossible to say what might have happened.
Yeah.
I think what's important is that, you know, we often, one of the justifications that people use about Christian dominance is that it gave us all this wonderful stuff.
Yeah, right.
The Sistine Chapel and, you know, the cathedrals and this and that.
Yeah, right.
And what we have to ask is, at what cost? Mm-hmm. How many millions, tens of millions of people have been killed for not being Christians?
Mm-hmm.
How many lands have been wiped out? Cultures have been eliminated? Mm-hmm. How many people have been burned at the stake, mm-hmm. tortured, etc.? So we have to, again, it's the context. We can take out a little piece of these things and say, wow, this is really a good thing. But at the same time, we have to step back and say, what is the bigger picture? And how do we want to move forward? Is that enough?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because if we look at the world today, dominant Christianity is still marching forth. We still are fighting wars in the Middle East that are crusades, basically, mm-hmm. under the label of manifest destiny and American exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not just Roman history. This is about what impact is it having today, not on just on our lives, but on people throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, that is a brilliant question.
Well,
at what cost?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, and that's good.
So have you ever been to the Sistine Chapel, Paul?
I have not.
Okay, so I have, and I was a senior in high school when I went. And so I'm looking up, and just, you know, the real naivete of a teenager, I'm going, okay, yeah, that's pretty, that's cool. But now I'm hearing that, like, you could have all kinds of different reactions as a human being looking up at that ceiling. One is like, this is a masterpiece of a brilliant artist.
Mm-hmm.
The other is if, like, somebody like Paul, that's why I asked him if he'd been there, is if to look up and say, okay, is this the trade-off? this is what we get. This is the plus on the plus column. And but Paul is grossly aware of the negative column, and the scales of justice going, no, I don't know that I can appreciate this art in this moment because of that's a fascinating
thought.
At
what cost? Yeah, great.
And I typically hate speculation. I mean, it almost drives me nuts when because it's such a waste of time. However, I do think it might be a worthwhile exercise, this question you're asking about this the bridge and what would have happened. And one of the things that does come up in the context of argument and apologetics is when Christians say, well, look at all the hospitals we built, you know, and look at all the good we've done. Mm-hmm. And there is a moment of speculation that says, well, all right, let's say that we didn't take this Christian path and we actually just became a more and more secular. Disease is and was going to be there. Human compassion is and was going to be there. We would have built hospitals, with or without this grand narrative of whatever, God and Jesus. We would have figured out ways to solve problems. Maybe, definitely faster and more efficiently than we would have without all this baggage of dogmatic and doctrinal bullshit.
Could be.
Okay, so anyway, Paul, I really appreciate the book and all the seriousness. Now, just we always close with some stuff to just kind of cleanse our palate from all that heavy shit. And so, what are you reading right now? I imagine you're a reader. You're a writer. You got to be a reader, right?
Of course. I read a lot of science fiction because it really stretches my imagination, my vision of what's possible. You talk about alternative realities. What would happen? Well, science fiction is filled with alternative realities. So I particularly look for science fiction from the perspectives that are more marginalized, people of color, women, people who are queer, because it really challenges my normality, my, you know, the things that I think are just the way things are.
You're straight, right?
Yes, I am.
So I guess what I'm saying is that we're three straight white males sitting here talking to each other.
Yeah, true.
Right.
With just layers of privilege. And so I love the way, and I've made some friends like us, or at least like Paul, at my experience with the Vanderbilt Divinity School when I went there, that there were several white straight males that were just bending over backwards to try to walk a mile in the shoes of people that don't have these layers of privilege that we have. And I appreciate that about you, Paul. So what about guilty pleasures or trivial pleasures, like some TV or movies or something that you're into that entertains your life?
Well, I would have to say my grandkids.
Okay. Great. That's not trivial, though.
It's not trivial, but it's fun and it's light and it connects me with a lot of joy and creativity and, you know, just the incredible exuberance and inspiration that being around young people brings to all of us.
Yeah. So, how many grandkids do you have?
I have two and a third one on the way.
All right. What ages are they?
9, 6, and
one on the way.
4 months.
Wow. Well, they're lucky to have you as a grandpa.
Yeah. So you're out there in California.
Uh-huh. Oakland.
Oakland. You like it there?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful settings in terms of the mountains, the coast, the bay. Mm-hmm. It's culturally, it's got a history of resistance and diversity that offers a tremendous amount.
Yeah. What school did you attend, Paul?
I went to Reed College.
Okay. I'm just wondering.
In Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm.
Reed College is where the book Blue Like Jazz takes place. Have you ever? It's a Christian book.
It's also a movie. Yeah,
Blue yeah. Like and Jazz. They made a movie out of it. Mm-hmm. But it was one of the stepping stone books for me to get out of Christianity. The guy that wrote it's still a Christian and would probably resent that. But it was a stepping stone book for me. Sure. So do you write for a living?
No.
What do you do for a living?
I think very few people write for a living.
How true. Yes.
I do educational work. I do talks and trainings and workshops around issues of violence prevention and social justice, both in schools and with adult groups, community groups. That's what's brought in some money. The books, you know, bringing trickle in some funds.
Sure. Yeah.
So are you working on a new book?
No, at this point, I've written a number of books over the years.
Sure.
And curricula. So I figure I've had my say. It's time for a lot of more younger activists, organizers, educators, community leaders to step in and have their words out there.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I really appreciate you coming on, and we wish you the best. And I want to talk to you after we get offline here for a second, so don't hang up immediately. But thanks.
It's been great talking to you. I would like to just direct people to my website.
Absolutely.
I have two. One is my general website, www.paulkivel.com.
And that's PaulKivel.
Kivel, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Mm-hmm. And then, but the other one is more relevant to the topics we've been talking about. It's www.christianhegemony.org.
Yeah, .org.
Right, right.
All right. Really appreciate it, Paul. I love your spirit. I love your heart. And I think that you're I know that you're a good influence on the world, and you're making the world a better place.
Thanks, man.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Right. It's been talking with you.
Yeah. Okay. Us too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.